Why is it that some people hold on to this certainty, kind of an idealization of a view or a demonization of other people? Why does that occur? So that's going back to fear of breakdown in this book. The question is, why are people looking for leaders that will value some and destroy the others? So that kind of politics of complete intransigence, what is that about? So my view is that actually what it's about is a radical insecurity in those parties. We're also, you know, we can all do this. The more times we get more adamant and, you know, black and white about things, usually underneath that, there's some insecurity about one's own situation.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is Season 2, Episode 2 of Damn the Absolute. First off, I want to introduce you to a new podcast from Eradicus, released this past October. Hosted by Derek Parsons, Curiosity Manifold is a podcast that tries to notice easily overlooked aspects of human experience. Through brief anecdotes and affable storytelling, Derek delivers some philosophy-infused observations that I think will satisfy both the heart and the mind. You can find new episodes wherever you listen to podcasts or at eradicus.co. Secondly, if you're a fan of Damn the Absolute and one of our guests has spurred a thought you'd like to write about, maybe they've said something that upset you or missed the point, Eradicus is always open to thoughtful submissions. Please check out the submission guidelines at eradicus.co for more details. Now, on to our show. Democratic deliberation can be viewed in a few different ways. It can be approached as a means of competing interests coming together to bargain between groups until they come to some kind of political agreement. From an epistemological sense, deliberation is what we do in the absence of certainty. Where uncertainty exists, so does the political. This requires us to practice, as the political philosopher Hannah Arendt says, thinking without banisters. Deliberation takes place as members of a community discuss and determine answers to perennial questions. What is real? What is moral? What do we value? And how can we best address our political or economic problems? Now, there's a third form of democratic deliberation, one often overlooked or underutilized. Deliberation as a way of working through emotional trauma. Rather than debate the significance of certain political events and which legislative action should be taken, this more therapeutic view considers deliberation a tool for helping communities process emotional cataclysms or psychological maladies, especially past ones left unacknowledged or repressed. This can happen on a personal level or collectively for a community or a generation. Think of it like political activism as a massive group therapy session. This third form is advocated for by Noel McAfee, a professor of philosophy at Emory University, with a secondary appointment as professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences. She is also the director of Emory's psychoanalytic studies program. In her 2019 book, Fear of Breakdown, Politics and Psychoanalysis, which won the American Psychoanalytic Association's 2020 Courage to Dream book, McAfee applies a psychoanalytic lens to some of the most pressing political issues faced by American democracy today: racism, inequality, alienation, and globalism. In this conversation, we reflect on a few things. What is the fear of breakdown, and how does this anxiety make democracy more difficult to practice? What are some psychoanalytic explanations for the rise of nativism and authoritarianism in the United States? What are some of these political ghosts and wounds that remain submerged or repressed? And what does it look like to use democratic deliberation as a form of collective therapy? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Noel, welcome to the show.
Jeffrey, it's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
We like to start in a place of uncertainty. A lot of us are afraid of uncertainty, but that's where we like to start. What is a viewpoint you've held as an adult you were confident or pretty confident wouldn't change, has actually shifted pretty dramatically for you?
Well, okay, this one is rather esoteric. I don't think it's a view that people who are not philosophers think about or not.
Let's hear it.
But I started off when I was in graduate school being like most other people who came out of a kind of deconstructive postmodern feminist perspective, very against the whole Enlightenment ideal of autonomy. I started off against autonomy. Autonomy conjures up notions, this Enlightenment notion of the individual who doesn't need anybody else and is not influenced by anybody else. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the ideal. And from a feminist or a post-structural point of view, we think that's just bullshit. Can I cuss on here?
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. Of course we're influenced by other people. And of course, desire is not a terrible thing. So this notion that mostly comes from, a lot of it comes from Kant, but it's just in the air we breathe. I was against that, against autonomy. And then actually, as I started getting interested in psychoanalysis and getting a different conception of what autonomy means, if you give up autonomy, does that mean we're just going to be pushed around by other people? Mm-hmm. That if we're not autonomous, that we're just relational through and through, there's no self there, that people were all flipped out 20 years ago about the death of the subject, there's no person there anymore, who are we? So that the postmoderns were giving up agency and autonomy and all that. And that kind of troubled me, but I couldn't think about it until I started thinking psychoanalytically about what autonomy can mean, being free to play with desire and history and context to be a richer self. So it doesn't have to mean denying the effects of other people. It can mean incorporating those in ways that we choose to do that and to play with it. I mostly get this idea from Cornelius Castoriadis, who's one of my philosophical heroes from the 20th century. When I first started reading his stuff on autonomy, I thought, whoa. And then I realized he's not saying to deny desire or the id, but to play with it, that we're not just rational individuals. We're also passionate people with rich lives and other people. So it's a way, instead of saying no to heteronomy, the other, to say yes to other influences as we try to fashion our own lives.
And this may be difficult to pinpoint, but I'm wondering if you could come up with an example in your own life of your earlier view versus this more recent view, in which that changed view changed how you actually orient in a very concrete daily way. Did it change your relationships with people? Did it change anything more concrete in that sense?
Yeah. We all have fraught relationships with our early caregivers, right?
Indeed,
some people don't, and I'm so jealous.
Those are on the fringe.
Yeah. For most of us, there's some problems with a caregiver. So one of mine, who is no longer with us, was not a great person.
Mm.
And I wanted to excise everything about that person out of my life. But that was so I could be free. Even though I was against autonomy, I wanted to be the master of my life. And that seemed to mean cutting out those influences that were in any way negative. I've got a better example after this. So actually bringing in what that person, I don't have to cut them out of my life. I can incorporate the good and the bad, and I play with it and I make my life now. But we are who we are, not just because of the good parts, but because what we did with the less good parts, with the bad parts. And I think the same is the case for a lot of people who have, grown up in histories of repression and all. It's not a matter of cutting it out, saying no to all of that. But how do we play with it now? How do we take the bad things and make them part of a creative process of creating something new?
Listeners, I think, will cue in on some of the psychoanalytic talk, your language you're using. By training, you're both a philosopher and psychoanalyst. Is that correct?
I'm a psychoanalytic theorist.
Oh, there we go. Okay.
Yeah, I'm not I don't practice psychoanalysis, except is the whole body politic. I'm not a practicing analyst, but I've gone through the training at the Emory University Psychoanalytic Institute. So I have a certificate in psychoanalytic studies from them. So yes, I am both.
To provide some tools for our listeners who may not be as familiar with psychoanalysis or psychoanalytic theory, could you offer a basic framework for understanding the critical insights or tools that come from psychoanalysis?
You can say there's three things. One, it started off at the end of the 19th century as a way to treat neurotic patients, right? Patients who had symptoms with no organic basis. So Freud and his colleague Breuer were trying to treat patients with this. So it was a therapeutic technique. Primarily, it was say whatever comes to your mind, don't censor it, and let's just see where that takes us. What do we learn about yourself? And hopefully, we will uncover blockages that have led you to be suffering and have these symptoms. So free that up. That changed because Freud realized that there was a lot more to do than just remember what had been forgotten to somehow work through resistances. Well, we can come back to that later.
These blockages you're talking about, can you articulate or elaborate on that a little bit more? What are these blockages you're referring to?
Oh, a repression. Say, so for some of these patients that they were dealing with, they had suffered, and mostly they were young women. They had suffered some kind of sexual molestation or something inappropriate when they were small. And they, as adolescents, blocked out any memory of that and then would have symptoms, a symptom like my arm doesn't work or some kind of I'm gonna pee on myself or something. When there's something that's instead of the memory, there is they're forgetting, but there's a symptom. So it's literally to try to unblock the blockage of the affect. But I was going with this to say that this was the earliest a therapeutic, but in the process, Freud started writing what he called these metapsychological papers because he thought he was getting an insight into how the mind worked, right? And you know, this is very speculative. We don't know. We still don't know how the mind works, but this was developing a metapsychology of the mind. And that included things like understanding what happens in depression or in melancholia, what's going on there, understanding ego loss or dissociation. So understanding what underlies these different symptoms. So developing a metapsychology, not just of people who are suffering and neurotic, but of all human beings. How do we take in the world? How do we see? And from that, we can actually extrapolate and see how groups of people work, because we're not just isolated individuals. We are born into communities. We'll come to this more as we go on. So it offers an insight into how the human mind works. And that's an insight that can be used beyond helping a particular person, but also can be used, folded into everything from literary theory and art, like the Surrealists used it in their art, into sociology and understanding communities. So it has, psychoanalysis has lots of wide value. I could go on and on about that, but I'll pause.
Absolutely. Let's unpack a couple of these concepts. You mentioned the notion of working through, which is a concept Freud came up with. I believe the German word is Arbeit. What does working through often look like?
Yeah, this is I started reading Freud more as I was writing this last book, the Fear of Breakdown book. And it was really, really hard to find what he said. Okay, so for example, he wrote an essay, Remembering, Repeating, and Working Through. And the bulk of the essay was on remembering, repeating. And in the last two paragraphs, he went, oh, I said I was going to say something about this. And he said pretty much nothing. And he comes back to it in 1926 and it says a little bit more, right? But there's literally little. And then I write this whole book with this as a key concept. And people later said to me, you never actually define what you mean by working through. So it's a great question. So I've thought about it since writing that book. So usually working through is in the context, working through what? Like some kind of trauma or loss, right? That's when we need to work through. I mean, somebody's stuck with an anxiety or a grudge or a pain, and it just keeps tormenting them. Or they keep finding themselves getting into the same kinds of messed up relationships, drawn to the same people who do the same thing. So this is like, why? What is going on? Or the taking, you know, getting a job and then failing at the job. So something is wrong there and has to be worked through. So first part is to understand what the symptom or the repetition is trying to ward something off. Maybe I'll keep trying to make a relationship with an alcoholic work because my father was an alcoholic and I could never get his love. Maybe if I get this person's love. So to identify in, you know, some psychoanalysis or writing novels, to identify what is it that needs to be recuperated or worked through? So the first thing, I believe, is to bring that into consciousness, into experience.
And that's where in the earlier generations using hypnosis to hopefully trigger some of the things people were getting stuck on. Freud is using free association, hoping to trigger so people can understand this thing I'm not fully aware of is keeping me stuck. And now I can articulate that and work through it.
Yeah, that's a good point. So yes, what one of the things that Breuer was doing with his hypnotic technique was helping to bring it into consciousness. So that's one simple way to make something present. But as I was talking about in Fear of Breakdown, that the phrase fear of breakdown is taken from D.W. Winnicott, mid-20th century psychoanalyst who noticed that in his more psychotic patients, that they'd say things like, "Doctor, I'm going to fall apart. Doctor, I'm going to die. Doctor, I'm going to have a nervous breakdown. Doctor, it's something terrible is going to happen to me." They're just struck with that. And he noted, what we have to explain to them is that this fear of something to come, a future breakdown, is actually a fear of something that already happened when they were small, you know, infants. Their experience like, "Oh, where's my mama?" or some whatever it might have been. And that was, it was an overwhelming experience that they could not tolerate. So it never made its way into consciousness. It was never experienced. So it'd be like being in a horrible car crash, but all your trauma mechanisms say you just immediately forget it. So you have an amnesia or something. The task of the first step of working through is to remember it or to experience it. And then with it, to experience all of the affect, emotions, and fear or anxiety, loss, whatever it might be, depending on what it is. So that first thing is to experience it. And the second, I think, is to actually then begin to do what is called for next, whether it's mourning something that was lost. Maybe it was the death of someone or something I care about. Or maybe it's a fear. To work through then would be to kind of metabolize that thing that had not been experienced, to experience it and metabolize it. Just like one day, you know, if something terrible happens and we have a good cry, the next morning we feel better because it's just something about just experiencing that helps to metabolize the feeling. And then I think the third part is to move on to refashion our lives, to just as we were talking about before, to take, okay, I lost that, or I'm not going to become the great baseball player because I threw out my arm and I'll never be that. And to say, okay, what else can I do? How can I create something new? So I think those are the three things involved in working through.
In the tradition of a psychoanalytic theorist, you take these insights and turn them toward politics and democracy. Commentators have been talking about threats to democracy and the undermining of democracy for at least the last century and a half, perhaps since forever, since the concept of democracy has been around. What do you see being some of the biggest threats to American democracy today? What keeps you up at night? I'm sure you have a long, long list, as many of us do, and many of us should have a long list, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, first, you're right to say that it's not just a century and a half. From the beginning of democracy, there have been threats to democracy, and many thought their democracy posed a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't always bow down and woo-woo to democracy. People thought it was the masses, the rabble. It would be complete chaos and anarchy if we let the people rule. So this kind of recent romance with democracy is new, but it's been tamed. No sooner did we get it in the revolution, the French Revolution, the American Revolution, but it was immediately tamed. So it's going to be tamed by making sure we have separation of powers, which is fine. I'm all for that. That we have representation. So people aren't directly ruling themselves. They're represented. And then in the early 20th century, ideas of, well, we should make sure that people who are really experts or have the representative roles. So there, I mean, a lot of the ways to tame, diffuse the role of the people, because the people could do the stupidest things, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there's no basis for, so I have an issue with that. So as that's one, just the expertise representative, actually, that we have a democracy in name only, because really it's people have very little power.
Yeah.
There's a backlash against that. Let me, before I go there, what's a shame about this taming of the people's voice is it means it has little appreciation for the way that people can be wise, right? How to educate their discretion, as Jefferson put it. The birth of democracy in the 6th century BCE, well, there was probably other democratic self-rule, but let's say in Athens, was largely fostered, cultivated by the poets and the playwrights who held in these public venues, these, you know, the stage exercises and understanding how to deal with complex, tragic things or how to deal with your hubristic leaders through satire. I mean, these were ways to practice. Well, how is it that we choose? What are we going to do? Because there's no right or wrong answer. There's no right or wrong answer. So we have to figure out ways to do that. First, in the history of democracy, there's been a pushback against the people having any voice, and then much less having an opportunity to educate their discretion. So what you have is direct democracy at the ballot, like Proposition 13 way back in California, that was a first example of direct democracy in the United States, and people were appalled. Do you remember this? You were
no,
just before
year was
you were
this?
Born. I think it was in the 70s, 1970. Okay. So yeah, I was just a kid. But I remember it was like a big deal because these California people put on the ballot a ballot measure that would basically limit any property taxes because they were so fed up with paying taxes. They limited property taxes and they basically destroyed the infrastructure of California, the inability to really raise, you know, enough money to pay for proper schooling, for example. So it was a very poor choice. The issue then is, instead of saying, well, then let's just make sure the people don't have any ballot opportunities, how can we have a more deliberative process for the people to make sounder, wiser choices? All right. So that's part of the answer to your question is just the age old battle about whether democracy is a good thing or not and how to do it. But with the whole expertise and we'll make sure it's representative and all, what comes out of that is people getting fed up with the swamp, the insiders, the elite in Washington or in the state house. Also, the Fortune 500 that rule the world. People have felt so disenfranchised that the reaction against that is hyperbolic and not great. I mean, I think that a lot of what feeds into populisms, the kind of bad demagogic populisms, is this reaction against keeping the people out of politics. Those are the big ones.
You mention, it's one of my favorite John Dewey quotes, actually, in this dynamic between experts and democracy or the voice of the people, and the draws this image of the person who wears the shoe knows where it pinches and how it pinches, but the shoemaker is the one who knows how to address that problem. And I love the imagery there, but I will admit I struggle to sort of resolve what that looks like in the most practical terms nowadays of how we... How does that look like in the United States today to balance the expert with the power of the people? How do you find a resolve there? Or maybe you don't.
I do, actually. In the 1990s, I was involved, it was the late 90s, with Jim Fishkin, who runs an experiment called deliberative polling. And we were requested by the Texas Utility Commission to run a public hearing process that, instead of just a free-for-all for who wanted to show up and weigh in on whether or not the electric utilities can build another plant, they wanted to actually have a deliberative process for the ratepayers to decide whether they should build another plant. So it was going to be public input through this process. The process called for getting a representative sample of the ratepayers of the Louisiana utility or the West Texas one. I forget what their names were. And we brought them together. We had these briefing materials that all the different parties, stakeholders had helped sign off on and presented to the people a range of options on what to do about nuclear. I mean, not nuclear power because that wasn't on the table. What to do about utility, electricity production. Now, all the experts before that said the people will never, ever accept renewables because they're expensive and they don't do much. So if you had left it to the experts, they would not have gone with renewables. They would have thought that it's too expensive. It's not feasible. But when those people deliberated and they looked at conservation or renewables or more coal or more electricity, they all said, you know, well, the overwhelming majority said, if we could pay a little, we would be willing to pay a little extra for renewables because in the long term run, that seems like it's better. And that fit. I mean, that's where the shoe pinched for them was like, well, wait, what are we going to do about the long term? Don't we need to have some kind of better energy source in the future? And as a result of that, in Texas, they went towards wind and solar, and there was investment in that. And we saw bad stuff last winter when Texas froze. But you remember all of the wind power. There was the wind power was there because of what those citizens said, those ratepayers said. So there's an example, I think, very concretely when people can tell where the shoe pinches.
We'll probably dig in a little bit later on this. But I want to get a contrast here between that take and what might be considered a more neoliberal take to the question of people giving their voice where the shoe pinches in the notion of you have a lot of choices in a marketplace and you get to choose where your what solution fits your own needs. And that's a way in which the market under a neoliberal framework provides a voice for people where they get to choose which of the market solution fits their need. How does that sit with you, and where do you find some criticisms to that neoliberal mechanism as a way of reaching the voice of the people?
Well, we can go back to Texas last winter. Right. So in between the late 90s, when they did the solar and wind infrastructure, then the kind of neoliberal leaders of Texas made some decisions, say, to cut Texas off from the rest of the grid, have it all kind of free market. You pick which service provider you want for your energy to your house. Mm-hmm. Right. So it was exactly what you're describing, a real the Wild West, pick your own provider. But there was no oversight. There was no a way to set the brakes when something's going wrong. There was no focus on the public good for Texas. And when this happened, this catastrophe happened, if people don't remember, it got really cold. It got crazy cold, like down to zero and stuff in Texas. That never happens, hardly ever. And suddenly people were, everybody's turning on their heat and it all crashed. Then people who were able to get heat, a month later, they find a bill of $1,000 because the way the free market worked was that, okay, you'll pay more if you need more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that people were really happy. In fact, since after that, people were saying this was not good. Being given a choice of which private company to get my electricity from is not addressing where the shoe pinches. The shoe pinches because we don't have a basic electrical safety net to take care of people.
I want to step a little bit into some of the philosophy behind some of the politics we're talking here. And I really like this definition you use of politics being the practice of deciding in the midst of uncertainty. And you talk about uncertainty in the epistemological sense. I'm wondering if you could elaborate a bit more on what that means.
In the many political disagreements, some people often think I have the right answer, you have the wrong answer. And there's a disagreement. If there wasn't a disagreement, it wouldn't be a political issue. Whether to stop at the red light on the corner is not a political issue because generally it's agreed upon. Yeah, it's a good idea to stop there. It's agreed upon. Whether it's the truth of the matter is kind of irrelevant. People generally agree. That would be a good idea to stop at that red light, not to just run it when you want to. So things become political issues when there's disagreement. Now, often people think, well, there's a disagreement because those people are idiots and I'm right.
Naturally.
Yeah. Now, I mean, on some things that are more amenable to factual truth, whether nuclear power is a good idea or not. But usually, even there, it's all wrapped up with what kind of community do we want? What do we think is important? Should we? And usually the political issues are not matters of fact. They're about what is it we want? What do we think is important? Say over abortion. Should a woman have a right to decide what to do with her own body or not?
Mm-hmm.
And the other side might think, should people be able to abort a living being? Right. So there's disagreement. And there's not any book that we can refer to like, oh, I've got the book. Here's the answer. This will tell us what to do. Because maybe I have a book I like that says, here's what to do. But the other person says, I don't believe in your book. So there's disagreement. And ultimately, we have to come to agree on something. That's what politics is trying to figure out, finding how to decide what to do when we don't agree and we don't have any basis for agreement. So that's what we might call politics without banisters. Arendt used that term, Hannah Arendt, without something to lean on. Right? Maybe I'm right about my view, and I certainly believe a woman has a right to decide what to do with her own body. In the tribunal of public opinion, it's a matter of wooing others. And sometimes there's no right or wrong answer. Should we take our wealth and build more schools or build more museums or public space? I mean, we have to decide together. For Arendt, most political matters, creating something new, is going to be doing it without a foundation, without something to hold on. We're going to create something radically new, and we have to figure that out together. This is unsettling, okay? Mm-hmm. This is unsettling because, oh, hell, I mean, how do I know I'm doing the right thing, right? Whenever we're trying to make a decision, should I move? Should I marry this person? Should, have another? All these decisions are uncertain. We don't know what's going to happen. It's scary. And if we go looking for an answer, okay, that might be an easy way out, but it avoids the actual exciting challenge of creating something new together.
In this thinking without banisters, we don't have a book of life where we can all turn to and say, here's the truth. And we beat people over the head who disagree until they agree. That's not really how it works. How, in your own sense, So this isn't a political science question, more of in your own experience, but what sense do you have for how common it is for people to approach politics in this way of acknowledging, yes, I hold firmly to my view, but I don't have a foundation, an unchanging foundation upon which I can stand? How common do you think people approach politics that way?
I don't think people think about it that way much at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I do think that when we're trying to discuss with others, what should we do on any of these questions? I think most people want to get other people to agree, not because I said so, but because the other person also wants to. We're trying to change somebody else's heart and help them to agree with us.
You mentioned you don't feel like a lot of people view politics in that way of thinking without banisters. Do you think there is, outside of academic circles and the more general publics, do you think there's a benefit in trying to, I guess, champion or rally that view in the sense of trying to point out to people we don't really have a firm foundation on which we stand? Is there a benefit in having more people embrace that view of politics? Does that help us solve problems better?
I would approach it kind of the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's begin with some of the more dysfunctional kinds of politics occur when people are dead set that they're right and other people are idiots. All right, that's the super dysfunctional place where we get polarization, demonization, violence, when somebody is certain that their own view is right. You know, when somebody will accost an agent who says, please wear a mask, because they're so certain that that is a terrible thing. It's that kind of certainty that I have personal anecdotes, but I'll leave those aside. But, you know, being called names because I expressed a view and other people found it so offensive. Because so they were so sure that their own view was right. Why? So why does that happen? What leads to the, that's the psychoanalytic question. Why is it that some people hold on to this certainty, kind of an idealization of a view or a demonization of other people? Why does that occur? So that's going back to fear of breakdown. In this book, my fear of breakdown, the question is, why are people looking for leaders that will value some and destroy the others? So that kind of politics of complete intransigence, what is that about? So my view is that actually what it's about is a radical insecurity in those parties. And we're also, you know, we can all do this. The more times we get more adamant and, you know, black and white about things, usually underneath that, there's some insecurity about one's own situation.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could flesh that out a little bit more of, for me as an individual, let's imagine what type of perhaps childhood experiences might contribute to me down the road embracing a politics that is maybe more authoritarian, or as you're pointing to, being a bit more nativistic about here's who we are, the ones who happen to have the identity I've wrapped around, and the other are those we're going to cast aside. What might those events be in my childhood? Because I understand childhood development is very central to psychoanalytic theory.
Yeah, well, it's not just one's own childhood, but what's been passed mm-hmm. down. So to take the example of the past of 2020, right, the year of Black Lives Matter, that mm-hmm. George Floyd, and what all the, in a way, okay, this is just me being your dime store psychoanalyst, but the lost cause of this Civil War was an unmourned loss by white folks in the South who lost, you know, the story they tell, they lost our way of life. It was the war of Northern aggression. And we're good people. Those people who are trying to, you know, destroy us, they're bad people. There's an unmourned loss of that we actually lost the war and we might not have been such good people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe our people were not really good people. The stories are, oh, you know, there was the good slave owners. They made life better for their slaves. I mean, these stories.
The gentleman Robert E. Lee tale.
Yeah.
Or myth, I should say.
And then, and we're just going to, every 4th of July, bring out the Confederate flag to celebrate our way of life. And no, we're not racist. We're just celebrating our way of life. So it's a lot of complicated inability to mourn this lost way of life, an inability to grapple with one's own imperfections, one's people's imperfections. And then the notion of a people at all is really problematic. So those who stormed the Capitol on January 6th, the people, what they're, many of them clearly carry Confederate flags and all. I mean, this notion of a white America that's going to be replaced by Mexicans and black folks, this is kind of paranoia. I mean, it's utterly crazy, paranoia. So this is out of a place of deep insecurity, I say that. Part of the book that I've been developing a lot more since writing it is about what the psychoanalyst Melanie Klein called a paranoid schizoid position. I'm trying to get too technical here, but that is the kind of when the small infant, when the mama's not there, it's like, something's trying to destroy me and I'm getting hungry and I'm going to die. This kind of anxiety that something terrible is going to happen. Or no, here's something good. And it's always the something is the part. It's just a piece of something. It's not the whole something. This, and it goes back and forth between paranoia, splitting, anxiety. And then as the infant gets a little older, it realizes, oh, that's mama. Mama's here sometimes. Mama's not here sometimes. Mm-hmm. So it goes from a paranoid schizoid to a position of going, oh, I was mad at mama, and starting to grieve for it, feel bad about its rage and destructive feelings, and starting to try to repair and love. Klein calls that a depressive position. So it's confusing because depressive sounds like that bad, like you don't want to be depressed. Mm-hmm. But it's a position of feeling bad because you're trying to make up for something. And you think that's a good thing, right? When somebody feels remorse, for example, we think that's good. That's on the way to healing if you feel remorse. If you're stuck in, no, I was right, and never feel remorse, you think, wow, that's not good. So we have a kind of this political position of thinking the world is populated by angels and demons. They're out to destroy me, or here's the perfect savior for our people. It's a kind of paranoid schizoid politics. And what we need politically together is to move to a politics we are actually able to grieve and mourn and move on.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here, doing that podcaster thing and inviting you to rate and review Damn the Absolute wherever you listen to podcasts. It means a lot to me and the editorial team at Eradicus, who produces the podcast. Plus, it helps us continue bringing you meaningful conversations around fruitful ideas. Enjoy the rest of the show. I love this point you bring up of pairing deliberation with mourning. And I think for a lot of people, when we think of deliberation, it is this, well, here's a bunch of options of which is right and we're going to discuss. And then this is the one that's the right one, which there's some of that that definitely goes on in politics. But I think it's a bit alien for a lot of people to think about political deliberation as this mourning process.
Yeah. And let me say here about a little bit about the structure of the book. It's bookended by this concept of a fear of breakdown, that a lot of our polarized politics is a result of people beginning stuck in a very childish, really infantile kind of thinking of everything's evil people and the good people, the ones who are trying to destroy me and the ones who are going to save me. So that is a very infantile kind of thinking. A more mature thinking is one of realizing there's ambivalence and shades of gray. So how do we get there? So the question of the book is, how do we get to that as a country and in a world? How do modern societies try to move to that place that's so rare? You hardly ever see it. And so I bring in what I call these six democratic practices that go on what we can think of as the wetlands of democracy. This is a political practices carried on by the whole political system and primarily I'm focusing on the public space, regular folks in their day-to-day lives, in their neighborhoods, in their schools, work. What can we in our everyday lives do? And in a well-functioning democracy, there are certain practices that go on all the time. They still go on. We don't often notice them for what they are. First is seeing politics just like what I'm talking about. It's a larger process, not just what governments do. Politics is not mm-hmm. just what governments do. It's also the way we talk to our neighbors, our friends, and strangers. And then also seeing oneself as somebody who can make a difference, a citizen. And I use the word citizen to mean as an agent. You can be without papers and still be a citizen, or you could have papers and not do anything like a citizen, to be an agent in a world, to call a meeting of your neighbors, to something like that, to meet with larger members of the community. And then then we get into the practice of identifying problems and putting them on the public agenda. So I see the protests around George Floyd's killing and that was that work of identifying and thematizing a problem that Black lives should matter, making that a problem. So that's a political practice. And I think that's more familiar with thinking, yeah, that's what publics do. Mm-hmm. That's what social movements do. And then the next is deciding, all right, the matter gets on the agenda. Now, what are we going to do? How are we going to make, what difference, how are we going to make our societies more just So that involves deliberating. As you mentioned, and for people who do any political theory, we hear the term deliberation as something that people in suits do, or you do it in a rational way, where you're back and forth of rational argumentation. And I think, well, that does happen sometimes. But but what it really is thinking, well, should we go in this direction or that direction? And maybe I'm trying to convince somebody that we should do this thing rather than the other. But we're all torn between if we do one thing or the other, if we decide to build more parks and not put our resources into more schools. Well, there's a trade-off, or the other way around. Or, I mean, any choice, and you mentioned Dewey. Dewey says, any choice is a forking of the road. And a one way, we go one way, we're not able to go the other way. And we can't have it all. It'd be nice. So when we have to choose and go one way or the other, there's a loss involved. That's what I mean by. Or maybe I realize that, you know, we go this way, and that's some people in my community are going to lose out here. So we have to, it goes back to working through. We have to actually tarry with and feel that loss and not just deny it. Say, I can have everything.
When we think about democracy, political action, a lot of it is, and you write about this in the book, doing my duty to vote or writing a letter to the editor, things of that nature that are kind of non-social in a way of you're not talking with people per se, you're just doing your action. What might it look like for us to, in concrete terms, approach deliberation, democratic deliberation, as a mourning process? How do we inject some of these psychoanalytic insights or practices into our democratic practices?
Well, I've actually learned a lot from what some people in communities are doing. You mentioned working through, and then Freud's term Arbeit. So Arbeit is work. Daniel Yankelovich, those past the recent years, was a public opinion researcher in New York and California, and he helped start the Public Agenda Foundation. And with David Matthews, who's the president of the Kettering Foundation, they helped start the National Issues Forums, which is a network of, I mean, it can happen in your community college, in your prisons, and the local library. Anybody can go on their website, nifi.org, and get briefing materials so that people in your community can talk about what to do about the national debt, or what to do, how do we deal with a pandemic, or what are we going to do about, you know, any, name your problem. There's an issue book out there. Mm-hmm. And the issue books are written such that people have to work through the pros and cons of going this way, that way, or the other. Usually three different options. And each is forcing people to deal with the consequence of each one. And often what happens, and Daniel Kolovich called this process choice work. He was drawing on Freud's notion of work when he called it choice work. I mean, you're really sitting down, and it can happen in your community or at home when you're trying to decide whether to take a job or an up and move across the country. You go, whoa, I did this, but damn. Or did that, that'd be cool, but No, but that's the choice work. We can do that by ourselves. We do that with our families. We do it in our communities, and we can do it in these kind of deliberative forums. So anybody listening who's a college professor or a high school teacher, you can go and download these, and they're really great because they've been designed to help people work through choices, choice work. So Yankelovich was drawing on the insight of Freud to develop this. So I don't have to invent a way to do it because I think that's a great model of how to do this. It's a good question.
The public is an important concept, or physical, literal physical spaces that are important for deliberation to happen. And as we look at the past century, at least especially the last few decades, with the rise and dominance of neoliberalism, there are concerns about how commercialization and consumerism have undermined our sense of the public. Do you think that's true?
Yes. So Jürgen Habermas, still living, quite a productive philosopher, lamented several years ago that whenever he wants to find out what's going on politically in Europe, he has to turn to the business pages. It's not treated as a political issue. It's treated like the European Union's trying to decide with the European Commission what to do. So it's not treated as political, but as a business decision, as a kind of matters of efficiency. Yeah, I mean, the neoliberalism is a kind of emptying out of public space. It's substituting market solutions for human problems. Years ago, I had a professor who was a he was part of the Reagan team tax plan, but he said, look, whenever somebody tells you that this solution is more efficient, when you let economists decide political matters, then you've lost politics. Because politics is not about what is the most efficient thing to do. It's about what's in keeping with our own values and goals.
When efficiency is the ultimate good, there's a lot of, which is really that market solution, a lot of those other human values we have really tend to get cast aside.
Yeah.
To lean a little bit more into the psychoanalytic lens, where do you see the paranoid schizoid dynamic happening in our politics right now?
So I would say the kind of strange energy emanating by those from the many of the people who are avidly, hostily against people wearing masks against COVID, or hostile against any vaccine mandates. It's as if, in the last week, I think Trump at a rally, Trump called on people to get vaccinated and people booed him. So there's a kind of really strange, there's some strange stuff wrapped up in denying the danger of the coronavirus, of COVID-19. And it's hard to understand, except that, the paranoid schizoid things that Klein was talking about, it's really what we see is a kind of idealism and nihilism. There's something that's perfect or terrible. This is really one side of two sides of one coin. Whenever you get those who are absolutists who think my side is right, and if you deny it, then you think that everything is wrong. Absolutism and nihilism are not two different things. They're two sides of one coin. They think that there's either a right answer or a wrong answer. That if there's no God, then everything is permitted. So it's like either there's a God or it's all just a free for all. There's nothing in between. So William James, the pragmatist, pointed out the same thing. These are not different. These are two sides of one coin. So somebody wants there to be a truth or it's all falling apart. Something like that is at work here, I think, with the kind of COVID deniers, the vax deniers, the anti-vaxxers. Like, no, cannot. And it's a cataclysmic. If you're trying to have my kid wear a mask, you're going to try to destroy my child. It's a real paranoid situation. I'm just observing that. I don't really quite know what to do about it, except to ask, what else is wrong in your life? I mean, why this kind of precarious space where we cannot even begin to see some reason behind wanting to have vaccine mandates or wear masks in schools?
There's the ironic meme online or language of people retweeting a news article and just tweeting, "Who hurt you?" Which is a playful, ironic thing that people will say. But really, I think it's getting at some of what you're talking about is when there are dysfunctions within democracy or democratic communities, it's beneficial to look at places in which in someone's life or in a community's life where they have been hurt, where that loss has occurred, and to sit and listen and ask questions and not seek to, I'm going to prove why you're wrong, but try and find out, why are you hurting? And hopefully we can deliberate and mourn those losses and come through, work through to get to a more functioning place.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And to go back to a question you asked before about, does something happen in somebody's life and that they got this way? And I said, well, maybe it's, goes back generations. I think a lot of what we're seeing in the world today is the end of white supremacy, or your ticket to be at the front of the line is being called. You don't really, you need to wait in line with everybody else. And this sort of I've written about how I think that the notion of a white identity is itself completely a fiction. It's fabricated, right? So to be white isn't a thing, right? To be a descendant of a kind of Northern Western European identity of a people who were able to colonize the rest of the world out of the kind of those accidents of history or those crimes of history. We now come to think of some people as being white and having privilege over others. It's a whole legacy of colonialism. To be white is a product of a colonial structure. It's nothing like being, it's different from being Italian or even British or Scottish. It to be white is a kind of identity that is a fiction.
It's a big abstraction, right?
Yeah, it's exactly. Because, okay, it's not like I'm claiming my Scots identity, Not that I would want to, I haven't, but to claim a white identity for those who are doing it is to claim an abstraction, as you said, and it's abstraction that's based upon huge crimes that are now being questioned, called out. And that's, I think, the ultimate anxiety of losing that white identity and privilege, for it to be questioned, not even lose anything, because usually it's just the people that react so vehemently against Black Lives Matter. What? My life doesn't matter? Well, no one said that. Black Lives Matter says, despite the fact they're treated like they don't matter, they do matter. It's not denying your own identity, but it's felt that way by people with this kind of precarious, fraught identity. I think that's just kind of where a lot of what we've been talking about kind of leads to and touches on. And I think that's really a place for a lot more work and thinking.
I want to end on a really hopeful note. In your book, you write about the younger generations. You say, as long as there are young people, there will be people bent on revolting and doing things better in the future. What makes you most hopeful about the younger generations?
Well, my own young adult children, seeing them. It's like, oh, I never thought somebody would call me like retrograde or some. But I mean, they're just the and my students who want more. They're not going to settle. They're not going to settle. They want more. And they feel like things have been messed up and it's time to make it right. That's nothing new. Young people do that. Hannah Arendt refers to the newcomers. She would even talk about her students at the new school, the freshmen coming in as the newcomers. There's always going to be a new generation who will be in the world making it anew again.
Yeah, there's nothing more perhaps traditional or conservative than having the younger generation revolt and renew from what the previous generation did.
Yeah.
Well, Noel, thank you so much for sharing your insights and inviting us into deliberation as a mourning process. I think is really beautiful and a lot of work to do. But thank you so much and good luck with your next book.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thanks for listening to Damn the Absolute. I want to show some love and appreciation to those who have recently been talking about Radicus and Damn the Absolute online, specifically you people on Twitter. Thanks to Lisa Humbertson, Eclectic Spacewalk, Adrian Rutt, and Allison Hinke. Tweet at us at Radicus Mag or me at Jeffrey_Howard_. Pester us with some of your favorite quotes from Damn the Absolute guests or pitch us on episode ideas. And again, please rate and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. It really goes a long way in helping us foster a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you all next time.